From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you really want to get a handle on what makes us human, you might want to see how we compare to our fellow apes.
We are the most bipolar ape, as I call us, in the sense that we have extremely vicious and violent tendencies. And then we have very high levels of empathy and love and altruism.
This hour, we'll dig into our DNA and consider how human nature is rooted in our primate past, which means we also have plenty to learn from our ape relatives today, from chimps to bonobos. And what about our Paleolithic ancestors some 30,000 years ago?
You know, they would have no trouble going through universities, medical schools, law schools, whatever. And I would bet that although Neanderthals would look a bit different, if you had a Neanderthal child raised in a family in middle-class America, that they would probably do just fine as well.
We'll also take stock of the biggest ape of them all, King Kong, and the 1933 movie that inspired all Hollywood blockbusters to come.
Filmmaking in general owes a debt to King Kong. I mean, movies are about magic. So I think Kong really inspired a lot of Hollywood movie making and creativity.
But first, a voice from the jungle. That's the cry of an orangutan, the red ape that lives in the steamy jungles of Borneo and Sumatra. Carl van Schaik is a Dutch anthropologist who's been studying orangutans for nearly 20 years, especially one group of Sumatran apes that shows clear signs of learning passed down from one generation to the next. This study may offer insights into our own cultural evolution. Van Schaik's written a book called Among Orangutans. He told Steve Paulson that red apes are full of surprises.
We're pretty sure that they live easily into their 50s and maybe into their 60s in the wild.
Wow, that's incredibly long.
Exactly. Well, I call them slow motion animals because everything is slow about them except their minds. So, for instance, it takes about 15 years for a female to start reproducing. And then the average interval between subsequent births of one female is 9 years. So they're amazingly slow. And then they live this very long lives, and then they move around in the trees very slowly. Everything's slow about orangutans.
But that's astonishing that the females don't become sexually mature until they're 15 years old. I mean, that means they've got to stay around for a long time. They have to survive all those years before they can reproduce. I mean, from an evolutionary perspective, that's kind of mind-boggling.
That's exactly right. In other words, if you are such a slow developer and you give birth so slowly, then you have to live to a long, ripe old age in order to balance this. And it raises yet another question, right? Why do they live so long? And that's where the intelligence and the development of intelligence and the whole issue of culture comes in.
The whole issue of culture. You're saying orangutans have culture.
The first thing that struck us, the book is about a story of a rather unusual population where we found animals using a variety of tools. And everybody in the population was using these tools. And I had worked earlier and later again, too, at another site that's only about 70 kilometers away, where nothing of that sort ever happened. And so the question is, well, why do we see that here and not somewhere else? So why does this amazing geographic variation?
What kinds of tools were they using?
No, you have a tree with a little hole in it, and it's, say somewhere up 10 meters up or something. And those little tree holes often contain nests of termites or ants, or most interestingly for an orangutan, stingless bees. So tiny little bees that don't sting but have little nests in tree holes that contain honey. And so how do you get in there? Because it's wooded. Your finger goes only so far if it gets in there at all. And so in some places, animals have figured out that if you break off a stick and sort of make it right, then you can insert it into that tree hole. And if you do the right manipulation inside that tree hole, you actually get the honey out, and you lick it off and you stick it in again and so on and so forth. Those tree holes are found everywhere, of course. There's stingless bees living in lots of those tree holes, but there's only a few places, I actually know of only one, where they then use the tools to extract them. And so it really opens up sort of a new niche for these animals. The second major form of tool use, which is for us easier to map, is there's a big fruit. It's a woody fruit, and it sort of opens, it splits, and then it displays nice rows of sort of lima-sized seeds, brown seeds, that are inside almost 50% fat. so really good to eat. However, they're embedded in a matrix of razor-sharp hairs. So if you or I stick our finger in there to pick one of those seeds or to sort of extract those seeds, then we're going to be attacked by those hairs and they pierce the skin and it's really painful. So what do you do? Well, orangutans have figured out that as soon as that fruit splits open and the seeds are sort of visible, you can scoop out those seeds with a tool and drop the seeds in your mouth and don't have to worry about those hairs. And so what we found is that everybody in the population does those different kinds of tool use. And you move somewhere else and then nobody does it.
Hmm. So they all learn from each other.
Exactly. So the conclusion was it's not the forest, it's not the fruit that's different, it's the animals that are different. They must have learned it from each other. Somebody invented it, and then it was maintained because they learned it from each other.
Well, this raises fascinating questions about human evolution. And,
exactly.
At what point did our ancestors start to diverge to become something that resembles the humans that we know today?
Right. And so because orangutans and chimpanzees were actually extremely similar in their cultural basis, that suggests to me that the first hominids, the first upward walking apes that became our, us, that they came equipped with this basic set of cultural skills. And so they were sort of like chimpanzees and orangutans in their capabilities.
Are we talking, 5 million years ago or so?
Yeah, 5, 6, 7, the jury's still out exactly on how long ago that is. And then for many million years, not much happened. And that changed at around 2 million, where you suddenly see these hominids that have a body built much more like us, that are clearly going out in the open, and suddenly you see tools that are a little bit more sophisticated that are clearly outside the range, the cognitive range of great apes.
It also raises an interesting question about why the most intelligent great apes, orangutans and chimpanzees, have not become more like humans. Well, why haven't they developed along the evolutionary path that humans did?
Right. And so that's the big question. Why did they stay where they were, pretty much? So why did this one lineage diverge in a really dramatic fashion? And I suspect at the moment, right now it's just speculation, because if you look at the cultural process, what sort of drives it? One of the things that's really important is how many experts are around you? How many animals are near you that know something you don't as you grow up? Term social tolerance or sociability there is key. Basically, the more tutors there are, the more time you can spend in school, the fancier your cultural repertoire is going to be. And that could sort of trigger a snowball-like process.
And so you're saying that there's only so much of that among the great apes.
I'm saying that basically their ecology sort of keeps them back because with this exception of this unusual population that I found, orangutans are really remarkably solitary. So they learn a lot from their mothers, and they learn a little bit from others around them, but the repertoire that you can maintain in a population is limited that way. And so if you create conditions, such as sort of what we do in zoos, you see a different orangutan from what you see in most wild places, because suddenly they can flourish.
And you're saying in zoos or in research labs, they show all kinds of skills. I mean, for one thing, there are those language tests that orangutans and chimpanzees have been able to master. I mean, fairly sophisticated manipulation of linguistic symbols.
Right. And so what that suggests is that you might say their latent capabilities, I say somewhere they seem to be overqualified for their jobs in the forest. And so what is created is this sort of blank slate that, depending on how rich the inputs are, can create an organism anywhere from a country bumpkin to a genius. And so the forest provides only that much inputs. You hit a ceiling there because ecologically they cannot live in larger units and be friendly and nice to each other without running into major competition. The site I worked at, that ceiling was much higher because the ecology was such that they could spend a lot of time together, and as soon as they can, they do. And so what I'm suggesting is that during human evolution, something happened that made that systematic, and then you sort of get into some synergistic feedback loop that you reach escape velocity, so to speak.
There would be a fascinating scientific experiment that probably would be unethical, but to take one or two of those zoo orangutans who've learned all kinds of stuff from humans and reintroduce them back into this group in the wild in Sumatra?
Well, you know what would happen? They would be considered idiots because they wouldn't even know how to climb trees decently. And we have some evidence that animals that were introduced into the forest and had taken with them a few rather irrelevant skills, for instance, eating cardboard out of trash cans, or trying to look for clothes on a clothesline and sort of draping themselves into it, that those habits have gone several generations down the line now. So there's a grandchild of one of the original released animals still doing it. But none of the wild ones, even though they have opportunities to observe this, have ever thought it was necessary to copy such a silly behavior.
But it also raises questions about what we mean by intelligence, in particular for wild animals. I mean, there's no reason why they should care about linguistic symbols or clothing or anything like that. It's not going to help them out there, at least
exactly. Not
for millions of years down the evolutionary road.
Right.
And so, you know, maybe it's unfair to say, well, orangutans or chimpanzees just aren't that smart because they don't do all the stuff that humans do, but why should they?
Exactly. Why should they? But culture is an essential component of intelligence. You might even say culture arises as a byproduct of intelligence because, like I say, you start out as a blank slate, and humans are more of a blank slate than, say, opossums. Now, you can create your own inputs by exploration and so on, but it's a lot easier to look at animals that were your elders, so to speak, that were clearly successful in this habitat and just copy what they're doing. So you can reach much higher levels of intelligence by social learning. So it turns out that intelligence is not this sort of solitary genius, you know, tinkering around somewhere in a dark corner. No, it is the social animals that turn out to be the intelligent ones.
And I suppose the other piece of this for orangutans is they would seem to have a certain capacity to learn these things, partly because they're so slow to mature. I mean, they're hanging out with their mothers for the first 15 years, and I presume the reason that they do that is they're learning all kinds of things. For some reason, that equips them to be more successful later on in life.
That's exactly right. So if you follow a mother-infant pair around, the youngster tends to copy what the mother is doing. They go into a tree, the mother eats, youngster eats. And then it's sort of, I call it guided exploration. It's very sort of conservative almost in its exploration. And it learns an immense amount of its mother. And then sort of by the time it's weaned, which is after, say, in Sumatra, 7-8 years, it sort of broadens its horizon a little bit and it meets other animals now in a more independent way so it can follow them around a bit. And what you see is it follows these animals very closely around. And when they're doing something interesting, like, say, some kind of foraging technique, they come closer and closer. You see them inching closer, literally to a few inches from their faces to see exactly what they're doing. They're just sort of gobbling up all this information to equip them for life. And, of course, the rule then is the richer your input, the richer your intellectual performance as an adult. And that is the process, I think, we're seeing magnified in humans. But the process itself is a lot older and a lot more general and probably also applies to some birds and some other mammals, you know, elephants and dolphins and so on.
Fascinating. Thank you so much for talking about all of this.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Carl van Schaik, talking with Steve Paulson. Van Schaik is an anthropologist at the University of Zurich in Switzerland. His book is called Among Orangutans. Every so often, a wildlife biologist will pull back the cloak of science and reveal something highly personal. It's the case with Birute Galdikas, the world's best-known orangutan expert. One of Louis Leakey's protégés, she was the first person to do a long-term field study in Borneo. Galdikas says her encounters with wild orangutans have, at times, felt otherworldly, especially when she has stared into their eyes and they've looked back at her.
It's almost like finding God. It's a powerful moment of transcendence. It's suddenly you realize that you're not alone in the universe. And those moments were very, very powerful. And of course, they came from the fact that there was total, absolutely total isolation. And they came out of the fact that there was total acceptance on the part of the orangutans, and possibly on my part as well, of the situation. And those moments had the intensity of a religious experience. The setting does reflect, you know, the kind of setting that we have in Gothic cathedrals or in mosques. There's sort of these beams of light, you know, that shoot from the sky, and there's a sort of a hush and a quiet. And I think that what churches try to do is they try to duplicate, you know, the ancient forest from which we came. And so, like, when you go into the forest, it's like going into a church, but not into a church created by humans, into the original church, into the original, you know, Garden of Eden, which was our home, which is where we became human. These kinds of experiences help explain why people frequently become almost addicted to helping certain species, or become addicted to nature. It's because they find something there that they can find no place else.
That's Baruta Galdikas of the Orangutan Foundation International. Have you ever had this kind of epiphany in the great outdoors? If so, we'd like to hear about it. You can send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. Coming up, another kind of big ape, the one who could climb skyscrapers and rip apart the jaws of a T-Rex. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Ladies and gentlemen, look at Kong, the eighth wonder of the world.
When the original King Kong first appeared, moviegoers had never seen anything like it. The giant gorilla was a marvel of movie magic, in fact, a breakthrough in cinematic technology. The man who dreamed up this mighty beast was Marion C. Cooper, a real-life Indiana Jones. Years later, Cooper reflected back on his life of adventure.
I was a little timid boy. Put that on your tape if you want. I made myself be a champion boxer and wrestler and fought three successful wars. I'm King Kong.
Mark Cutavaz has written a biography of Marion C. Cooper called Living Dangerously, and Strange Chimps talked with Vaz about Cooper and the making of King Kong.
When I was growing up, King Kong was a staple of late-night television. You know, it was just one of a dozens of those cheesy old horror films. And I have to confess, I didn't really realize until now what a remarkable movie it was for its time. I mean, in 1933, when it first came out, it was a really big breakthrough, wasn't it?
Well, actually, you know, it's funny because I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I recently had the chance to go see it. There's this great movie theater called the Castro Theater, and it was built in 1922. So I got to see 35mm print of King Kong, and to see that film in a true movie palace on the big screen, that's when you really get the impact of what an achievement it still is.
Talk some about what it took to make that film in that age with the movie-making technology they had. I mean, to begin with, King Kong himself was really just an 18-inch puppet, right?
Well, I mean, I think that's the amazing thing about the effects in King Kong is they hold on the quote-unquote effects for long minutes. I mean, there are entire sequences that are visual effects. And King Kong was an 18-inch puppet There was a fellow named Marcel Delgado who actually built a lot of the armatures, as they're called. These are like machined skeletal figures, and they put latex around it, and in the case of Kong, rabbit fur. So you have like this puppet, and then there was this fellow named Willis O'Brien, who is the pioneer of stop motion animation, as it's called. And it's called stop motion animation because you literally will shoot one frame at a time and animate one frame at a time. So you have 24 frames per second. That is the industry standard for simulating live action. So for 24 times a second, Willis O'Brien and his crew had to move those puppets just an increment, shoot it, and then do the next animation. All that stuff had to be coordinated.
One of the things that's remarkable about the original King Kong movie, it's not just that they get him to look lifelike on the screen. It's that he was interacting with the live actors. And, you know, we take this for granted today because we've got all that computer animation. But how did they get live actors and this 18-inch puppet together in the same scenes?
Well, one of the ways they did it, one of the tricks is that they had this thing called rear screen projection. And essentially, you had these little miniature sets, and you would do the animation of Kong. Built inside the sets were little screens. And on these screens, you would project previously shot footage of live actors. And meanwhile, you have your taking camera that's shooting that one frame a second. But at the same time it's shooting that, it's also taking in the whole set, the animation, and each frame projected of this live action that's going into these screens that are built into the sets, the miniature sets. It's a neat trick. And also the projection of the rear screen film footage had to sync up, obviously, with the camera that's taking the whole scene.
So this must have been quite a challenge for the actors to be playing opposite visual effects on a screen.
That's just the miniature stuff. Then there was giant process screens. So like when Fay Wray is up in the tree when Kong is battling the Allosaurus. And it was always the Allosaurus, by the way. A lot of people think it's a Tyrannosaurus Rex, but he's battling an Allosaurus. That was a gigantic screen that literally, physically, she's performing in front of. So Fay Wray actually described it. That was the first time she acted against a process screen, and it took like 3 days of working on just that shot to get everything to sync up correctly. And I think she would, of course, she had to scream through the whole thing, and she would later describe how exhausted she would be when she would go home after a full day of screaming, you know. So,
in fact, we have a clip from an interview Fay Wray did years later talking about how Marion Cooper, the film's director, got that legendary scream out of her. Maybe we could play that.
Marion Cooper said to me, "Scream, Fay, scream for your life." Well, who wouldn't? Even if you could only just imagine a giant creature like of that kind, you know? So that's exactly what he said. Scream for your life.
Generations of actresses have been copying that scream ever since.
Yeah.
You know, much of the credit for King Kong belongs to the man behind the movie, Marion C. Cooper. And he was like King Kong himself. He was a larger-than-life figure, a kind of real-life Indiana Jones.
Well, I guess my whole thing about Cooper is that King Kong, he really brought a lot of his experience to King Kong. It's practically autobiographical. In fact, it essentially is, because Marion Cooper and his partner, Ernest Schoedsack, who's also a co-director of King Kong, they were partners in the 20s, and they did these movies where they would go to like Persia, Africa. They would go to these really kind of remote wilderness places, and they would do essentially these movie expeditions. And that's what Kong is about. It's about a movie expedition. Marion Cooper was also a war hero. He was a bomber pilot in World War I. He also was a fighter and bomber pilot on behalf of the Polish Air Force against the invading Bolsheviks.
He was, I suppose today we'd call him a Type T thrill seeker, right?
Yeah, he was a lust for life or something. I mean, I really think he should be in the pantheon of American true life folklore heroes. You know, there's like Babe Ruth, there's certain people you mentioned, Lindbergh, that are kind of like embody certain iconic values of adventure or whatever. And Cooper just this whole idea of him with his pith helmet hunting man-eating tigers in the jungle and the World War I bomber pilot. There's certain images about him that we see those images and they resonate. The World War I flying ace, the hunter in the jungle. Well, Cooper embodied all that for real.
He was lucky to make it through some of his adventures. Wasn't he shot down maybe even more than once when he was flying?
He was shot down twice. In World War I, he was shot down, and they actually thought he was dead. And for the rest of his life, he had his death certificate made out and signed by General Blackjack Pershing. When he was fighting in Poland on behalf of the Polish Air Force, that was the serious one because he got shot down after like six bombing missions that he'd flown. He was captured, and since he was the co-founder of this feared aerial squadron that was bedeviling the Bolsheviks, he would have been killed instantly. So he had to go under an assumed name, but he survived like something like 10 months. They had these like prison camps around Moscow, and finally he felt he was going to be executed soon anyway, and he ended up escaping with two other Polish prisoners, and they made it to Latvia, the border of freedom. I mean, that whole survival thing was just completely amazing. I mean, he
survived one air battle that it reads like a scene from a movie.
The one in World War I is they were just returning from a bombing mission, and all of a sudden these German fighter planes attacked them, and they were outnumbered. And it was this huge aerial dogfight, and his plane is riddled with dozens of bullets. His observer in the back of his plane, Edmund Leonard was his name. Well, at one point, Edmund is shot through the neck, and Cooper thinks he's dead. At that point, the plane just explodes into flame, the cockpit does. And the weird thing about that era is what you have to remember is that no one had ever taken to the air in battle before. Planes were fairly new. And there was this weird code of honor, particularly the Americans did it. They didn't fly with parachutes. So a lot of these pilots, this would happen to them. Their cockpit or their planes would go on fire, and they would have to jump out of their planes. Either that or burn alive, you know. That was what was happening to Cooper.
What did he do?
He was on the edge of his plane ready to jump. And he looked back, and he saw that the eyes of his observer flutter open and realized that Edmund was alive. So he said, you know what, I'm going to try to land this plane. I can't jump out and leave this guy. He jumped back into the flaming cockpit and essentially accelerated the plane so that the oxygen essentially sucked out the flame. And then with his arm, his hands are so burned, with his elbows and knees, you know, working the stick, he managed to coast the plane into a nose point landing in a field where he was captured. But it was an amazing feat of flighting.
Well, if Marion Cooper had the kind of life that belonged on screen, and, you know, he put himself on screen in a bunch of his movies, how similar would you say Cooper himself was to Carl Denham, the filmmaker character in King Kong?
Well, Cooper was Carl Denham. In fact, when you look at the original King Kong, there's a little clue. The very first time we see Carl Denham, he has a pipe. Well, pipe was a big prop of Cooper's. He was a known pipe smoker his whole life. That's a funny little thing. In fact, Robert Armstrong, the actor who played Carl Denham, even looks a little bit like Cooper. And the other thing that's sort of poignant, I guess, is when Marion Cooper passed away, he was preceded into eternity by Robert Armstrong, who died, you know, just almost hours. Like, it was like the day before or something that Cooper died. So it's almost mm-hmm. like when Cooper's alter ego left the world, Cooper followed him.
Lieutenant, I'm Carl Denham.
Carl Denham?
Denham? Oh, that's the man that captured the monster.
Well, Denham, the airplane's got him. Oh, no, it wasn't the airplanes. It was Beauty killed the beast.
Mark Cutavaz talked with Anne Strainchamps. His book is called Living Dangerously, The Adventures of Marion C. Cooper. You'll find documentaries on Cooper and the making of King Kong on the special DVD edition of King Kong that's just been released. Coming up, more on Big Apes. A leading primatologist takes us inside the world of chimps and bonobos, and the real story about Neanderthals. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. much can we really learn about human nature by studying the great apes? A whole lot, says Franz de Waal. He's a primatologist at the Yerkes Primate Center in Atlanta. De Waal says our psychology is basically a primate psychology, shaped by the same social dynamics that have molded chimps and other primates. Franz de Waal calls his new book Our Inner Ape, but he thinks we really have two inner apes.
I'm a bit upset by the fact that people, when we do bad things, they always blame that on our animal side. So when we leave people behind after Katrina, they say we've been left behind like animals. And so as soon as we do bad things, that's our animal side. And if we do good things, it's our noble human nature that does it. And I argue that we have two sides. We have a nasty side, and if we are bad, we are worse than any animal that I know. But we also have a good side, and we are fortunate to have two close relatives, the bonobo and the chimpanzee, that highlight these two sides. So the chimpanzee is violent and territorial and dominance-oriented, but the bonobo is a very gentle, peaceful creature. And so we have this entire spectrum of behavior, and we have two close relatives that sort of illustrate it.
This is a fairly recent discovery, I gather. I mean, to the untrained eye, the chimpanzee and the bonobo look very much alike. It's clear that they're quite different, but that's not something that's been known for a long time, is it?
No, the bonobo has been discovered only less than a century ago, and there's very few of them in captivity. They are very highly endangered in the field. And so we know actually much less about the bonobo than the chimpanzee, of which there are many thousands in captivity. And the bonobo has been ignored. But this is not the only reason that they have been ignored. It's also because anthropologists have set up scenarios of human evolution that very strongly emphasize aggression. So we got where we are because we are killer apes and we have wiped out everybody else. We've wiped out the Neanderthals and so on. And so aggression is part of that story. Warfare is part of that story. And then when the bonobo came along, they didn't fit because the bonobos are too nice for that picture. And even though the bonobo is exactly equally close to us as the chimpanzee, and so I would argue exactly equally relevant as the chimpanzee, they have been put to the side because they have female dominance. No one knows what to do with that. They have sex instead of warfare. No one knows what to do with that. And so they have been ignored.
You talk about a matriarchal society among the bonobos and a patriarchal society among the chimpanzees. Is their behavior really so very different from each other?
Yeah, it is strikingly different. So, for example, the bonobo males, they hang out with their mom. I call them sometimes mama's boys. They travel through the forest following their mothers around. And their position in the male hierarchy, because there's definitely competition among the males, but their position is dependent on what kind of mother they have. If they have a high-ranking mother who's in good health, they can have a high-ranking position. Now, for chimpanzees, it's totally different because chimpanzee males, they organize all this stuff among themselves. Females are barely involved in the power struggles among males. That's all male business. And the males are fully dominant over the females also, which is not the case in the bonobo. So the bonobo is, yes, is a totally different animal. So to give one illustration, we have many pieces of evidence of killing among chimpanzees, either infanticide, where they kill infants, or killing among males in territorial fights. There's not a single instance known for bonobos, even though bonobos have now been studied for maybe 25 years. There's not a single killing among bonobos that has been observed in captivity or in the field. So that's a substantial difference right there.
There's quite a variety of behavior that you've noticed over the years, because it seems to me that you've told in the book Our Inner Ape two stories about chimpanzees, for instance. There are killings, as you mentioned, but there are other instances in which chimpanzees will band together to prevent violence, are there not?
Yeah, chimpanzees are cooperative animals, and chimpanzees have a level of empathy, a substantial level of empathy towards each other. I would argue that bonobos have a higher level. So, for example, there was a case of bonobos in Milwaukee at the zoo where they had a blind female who could not find her way, and so each time the caretakers called her in a building, she would get lost in that building. And after a couple of weeks of that, the oldest male of the group would go to that female, take her hand, and lead her to the place where the caretakers wanted her to be. Meaning that this male had an understanding of what the caretakers wanted, had an understanding of the handicap that that female had, and was helping out.
Of course, there are also things that the bonobos seem to enjoy more than the chimpanzees, and maybe we ought to be looking at that as well. You talk about the bonobos being sexual, and you're not kidding, are you?
No, bonobos, I call them the make-love-not-war primates. So, for example, when two groups of bonobos meet, there is initial tension between them, But then instead of fighting and killing each other, as chimpanzees would do, and we actually do sometimes, the bonobos then have what they call mingling. They're going to have sex with each other, and then they're going to groom each other, and the kids are going to play together. And so the two groups mingle, and then they separate again. And so they use actually sex to resolve issues. Also, after a fight, instead of reconciling with a kiss or an embrace, as chimpanzees would do, the bonobos have sex. And that's also why sex occurs in all combinations of individuals, because tensions occur in all combinations. And so you have sex between females and between males and all sorts of combinations of individuals.
Even, I gather from some of the stories that you tell, sex between adults and infants, or at least stimulation.
Yeah, all combinations occur. I should add, though, that the sex is pretty casual by human standards. So it's not like they're going to do a two-hour deal of sex or something. It's 10 seconds, 20 seconds. And I call them sometimes genital handshakes. Is the way we tap each other on the shoulder or shake hands, they have a little sexual interaction and then they move on.
Because then you have the flip side of this, which are some fairly horrifying stories about chimpanzees who engage in warfare and even kill other chimps that they had known quite well, had played with.
Yeah, chimpanzees, this was the first observations were at Gombe Stream, where indeed a group split. And after the split in the group, they started killing each other off. Even so, individuals who know each other and have lived together, they can still develop this kind of group identity that gets them then into warfare with each other. We understand it because in humans, this kind of thing can also happen where you redefine groups or split or whatever happens. And so then what happens is that males patrol their borders of the territories, and they wait for the right opportunity when they see a single male of the other group to isolate that male and to beat him up and bite him and leave him behind and let him die. And so, yeah, chimpanzees are extremely vicious.
So are you suggesting that we humans essentially share both of these genetic heritages, the chimpanzee and the bonobo, the violent and the peace-loving?
Yeah, we are the most bipolar ape, as I call us, in the sense that we have extremely vicious and violent tendencies that we sometimes use, especially against members of outgroups, not so much against members of our in-group. And then we have very high levels of empathy and love and altruism that are truly remarkable for our species that we can also use. And so we have sort of two pillars to build on.
We think of ourselves as far more complicated, and I suppose we are in many ways, but there are instances that you point out. There was a story you told about a baby. You called her the Little Rose.
Yeah, we had a baby chimp who we didn't know where to place, so we didn't want to place it in a human family. So we gave the baby chimp named Roche to a female chimpanzee. And we trained this female to bottle feed the baby because she didn't have any milk to offer herself. And so she bottle raised the baby chimp. And then later we introduced them to our large colony, a colony of more than 25 chimps at a zoo in the Netherlands. And we were very afraid, actually, for Roche because chimpanzee males can be infanticidal, and they are especially infanticidal with babies that they don't know or have never seen. And the alpha male of our group had shown hostility. So we had introduced the female chimp and her baby through the bars to him to see what would happen, and he had shown that he was trying to grab the baby. And so when we introduced everyone on the large island where 25 chimps were going to live together, we thought that that male might try to steal the baby and kill it. And we introduced him as the last individual to be sure that the female was surrounded by her protectors, her usually friends. And actually that worked because when the alpha male came out of the door and entered the island, the two other males, the two big adult males in that group, they stood shoulder to shoulder in front of the female and they didn't let him get close. So they united against him and they prevented him from getting even close to the baby. And he gave up after that, and there was a long grooming session that day between everybody, and they sort of settled on this issue.
One of the worrisome things about this is to look at the behavior of the chimpanzees, especially this violent behavior, and it makes you wonder if that isn't in fact our nature as well and our future. Do you think it is?
Well, I think we can certainly create circumstances in which people will be violent. But you can also probably create circumstances in which you bring the good out of people or the friendly behavior, cooperative behavior out of people.
Looking at the bonobos and the rather peaceful society that they seem to manage to establish, it does give you some hope, don't you think?
Well, the bonobos are more egalitarian and they're certainly more peaceful than chimpanzees and humans. People sometimes, in a sort of wishful thinking, they say, oh, I wish we were like bonobos. It's, of course, a species very popular with feminists because of the female dominance and very popular with the gay community because of all the homosexual behavior that's going on. But I would also say that we cannot live like bonobos because we have opted for a society in which there's a family structure where males are involved in the care for offspring. And as soon as you get a society like that, males need to have some sort of certainty about what kind of offspring they have, because males will only be involved in caring for offspring if they have some certainty that it's their own. And to provide that certainty, we have surrounded our nuclear families with protections that prevent us from having the sort of society that bonobos have, which is totally promiscuous and where everyone has sex with everybody. So yes, we can dream about the bonobo life, but it's not a realistic option for the kind of societies that we have.
Franz de Waal, he runs the Living Links Center at the Yerkes Primate Center. His latest book is called Our Inner Ape. Have you seen this TV ad?
At Geico.com, you can handle all your car insurance needs online. It's so easy, a caveman could do it.
Seriously, we apologize. We had no idea you guys were still around.
Yeah, next time maybe do a little research.
Eric Trinkus has done plenty of research. He's an anthropologist at Washington University in St. Louis and one of the world's leading scholars on Neanderthals. He told Steve Paulson that many of our assumptions about Neanderthals and our own ancestors, early modern humans, are just plain wrong.
Neanderthals were not that different from us. If you look at the associated archaeological remains of the Neanderthals and the early modern humans, they're essentially indistinguishable. They're indistinguishable in terms of technology. They're indistinguishable in terms of social behavior. The Neanderthals were the first humans to intentionally bury their dead.
How long ago was that?
The oldest Neanderthal burial we have is about 100,000 years old. Neanderthals independently evolved social behaviors such as personal body ornamentation. That's a very distinctively human characteristic where you're essentially changing your whole social appearance. Neanderthals did a number of these things. And so when these two groups encountered each other, they may have looked a little different. They may have appeared a little different one to the other, but they were all dirty. They were all smelly. They were making a living in the very same way off the landscape, and there weren't very many of them around.
Now, you've said that in many ways, early modern humans and Neanderthals were indistinguishable, I mean, in terms of, particularly in terms of culture. Mm-hmm. What about in appearance? What were some of the differences?
The early modern humans that spread into Europe were generally taller and slenderer, a more linear body build, whereas Neanderthals were a bit shorter, not terribly short by modern human standards. You know, an adult male Neanderthal on average would have been about 5'6", 5'7", adult female 5'2". But they were very stocky. And so you had differences in body build. And Neanderthals had bigger faces, more projecting faces, big noses, and they were very muscular.
I've also heard that they had bigger brains.
Actually, Neanderthals and early modern humans had brains that were indistinguishable in size. But the problem, of course, is that brain size is, as an absolute value, isn't very meaningful. You have to scale it to body size. Bigger people have bigger brains because they have bigger bodies to control neurologically. So Neanderthals were shorter but very stocky. The early modern humans were very tall, but more linear. Their body sizes were very similar and generally larger than most recent human populations. As a result of that, they had bigger brains. And actually, if you look at brain size over the subsequent 30,000 years, it gradually decreases as body size decreases. And then in the last couple of centuries, as people have started to get bigger, it's starting to go back up again.
That's fascinating. For one thing, I had no idea that Neanderthals and early modern humans were so tall. I had just assumed that human beings have just been gradually getting taller over the eons.
Actually, the earliest modern humans, the ones particularly in the period around 30 to 25,000 years ago, where we have a number of skeletons, the average male height, and this is average male height, was somewhere around 5'10", 5'11", which by living human standards is very tall.
Right.
You know, there are relatively few populations in the modern world where the average male height is that tall. And females were a little bit shorter, but in the same proportion as most recent populations. Those were very tall people. And they were also people who were doing very well as hunter-gatherers. There weren't that many of them around. in most environments, there was plenty of food. They had the technology and the organization to exploit it effectively. And we have archaeological sites from around the time period of 25, 26, 27,000 years that are just tremendously rich sites where people are very effectively essentially harvesting game animals. They're making fired ceramics. They have textiles, as well as they're trapping fur animals. They're doing all the kinds of stuff that we associate not only with very effective, you know, recent hunter-gatherers like historic Eskimos living in harsh environments, but they're also doing a variety of things that we normally associate only with settled agricultural populations. And when we look at their bones, they're generally very healthy.
If some of these early modern humans were plopped down into our world today and dressed up as we are dressed up, would they look different?
No. They would fit right into our population, you know, especially the American population, which tends to be fairly tall. They would fit right in. You know, some of them may appear to have large faces compared to most modern humans. On average, they had larger teeth than we do and a variety of little details like that. But if you saw them walking across the campus here, you know, sort of in the back of your mind, you might say, oh, that guy's probably, you know, on athletic scholarship or something like that because he has the body build to do that. But other than that, you wouldn't necessarily notice them.
And in terms of intelligence, from what we can tell from the brains of those human beings 30,000 years ago?
We really can't tell anything from the brains. We know how big their brains are because we have the bony box that they were in, but we know nothing about the wiring. Where we can tell intelligence is from the archaeological material they leave behind, the artifacts and decorative objects. And these are completely modern humans. You know, they would have no trouble going through universities, medical schools, law schools, whatever, and behaving in the modern world. And I would bet that although Neanderthals would look a bit different, I would bet that if you had a Neanderthal child raised in a family in middle-class America, that they would probably do just fine as well.
Now, the thing that's surprising to me from what you say about Neanderthals is that they seem to be very well adapted to making a living on Earth. I mean, they were smart. They were muscular. I mean, physically, it would seem that they were especially well-suited to living a rather rugged lifestyle. And yet, they're not the ones who've come down to us, really, who've made us what we are today.
Yeah, Neanderthals were very successful. You know, if you put it in terms of time and space, what we call Neanderthals were around for, you know, well in excess of 100,000 years. They seem to have lived in very low population densities on the landscape. They seem to have had, what we can infer indirectly, they seem to have had relatively unstable populations, that is, as local populations that under environmental stress crashed or people died out. And they had a lot of stress. They have a lot of broken bones, healed, which means they survived them. They have a lot of indicators of childhood stress, so seasonal starvation kinds of stress. For reasons that are not simply ones of intelligence or technology, the early modern humans were much more successful. And my bet, but this is something that's very hard to test, my bet is that we're looking at social organization. We're looking at the ways in which people were coordinating activities in sort of larger scale groups.
So the early modern humans tended to go around in bigger groups, and presumably they were better organized.
Yeah, that's the hypothesis. That's sort of the way of looking at it. And we have some indirect indications of that, some more indications of, for example, more specialization of activities.
Give me an example.
Well, for example, we know perfectly well that Neanderthals were able to hunt animals from small deer, goat, wild goat, up to the size of horses and do it effectively. But the weaponry that they had for that was weaponry that they would have made in the short term perfectly effective, but probably not very highly refined. One of the things we see with early modern humans is a great refinement of their weaponry. These are spears, but they're putting a lot more time and effort into making very effective points, very elaborate hafts so they can replace the points when they break. Clearly, an investment of somebody who's going to do this over and over again. And what this tends to imply is that there are some segment of the population who are, in effect, specialized hunters, and they are hunting for the larger group and then sharing that with things that other people are producing and processing. When we get into the period certainly by 27,000 years ago, where they're making ceramics, they're making textiles, they're processing furs, they're doing all of these kinds of things, it's very likely that you're looking at some pattern of division of labor. It could be sexual division of labor, males and females. It could be by age. But most likely it's going to be by who happens to be good at this as opposed to who happens to be good at that.
I'm trying to wrap my head around what you're saying because you're really kind of demystifying these early modern humans. I mean, you're kind of saying, well, you know, 30,000 years ago, they frankly weren't that different than we are today. I mean, really, what we have is we have the accumulation of knowledge, of culture and science and all
of
that.
Exactly. You know, we have no problem at all looking at, you know, peasants living in the Middle Ages and saying, these are people who, if they were alive today, would fit right into any modern technical society. You know, they just happened to be living in the Middle Ages and they were poor peasants and they were starving and, you know, they had wooden tools and hardly any steel tools because they couldn't afford them, etc. And we see that purely in a cultural historical sense, not in terms of any real change in human biology. Okay. We're talking about the exact same kind of contrast, except magnified many, many times, because we're not going back 1,000 years, we're going back 25 or 30,000 years. I think what's happened with many people is they see modern humans biologically as something very special. The Neanderthals are different. They're human, but, you know, they're not quite us. You know, the whole idea of Neanderthals and modern humans interbreeding, some people think this is wonderful, and other people say, well, you know, that's, you know, it's just...
There's something a little kind of monster-like about
them. You just don't do that kind of thing. But if you start out looking at what we know from the archaeology, from the artifacts and the archaeological sites, we have no problem at all having this go all the way back in time. There's absolutely no reason why Neanderthals could not have been, in effect, a simpler version of later hunters and gatherers.
Eric Trinkus is an anthropologist at Washington University in St. Louis. He talked with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a CD of this show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for The Big Apes Show, number 115A. If you have comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. This hour was produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Steve Paulson, with help from Doug Gordon, Mary Lou Finnegan, Veronica Rickert, Charles Monroe Kane, Anne Strain Champs, and Megan Manning. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.